It is tough enough to be pregnant and poor. Pregnant and poor and in jail adds a whole additional dimension. Our guest this hour observed and treated women in jail for several years in San Francisco. The results of her studies are contained in the book Jail Care, Finding the Safety Net for Women Behind Bars. And if your first thought is safety net, you realize that a woman in jail will at least get medical attention, one of many findings that Carolyn Suffren points out in her book. She does bring a couple of different skills to bear on the process. Carolyn is an MD, an obstetrician and gynecologist at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and she's a PhD, a medical anthropologist as well. Carolyn Suffren, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeffrey. I'm really happy to be here.
Good to have you. So you actually provided jail care. How did you get the job at the San Francisco jail?
Well, it started because when I moved to San Francisco, I had already cultivated an interest in the care of pregnant incarcerated women due to an experience I had during my OBGYN training in Pennsylvania. And in that training, I delivered the baby of a woman who was shackled to the bed. And she was at the local jail, and I was deeply troubled by this moment. Of course, I'm sure not as much as this woman. And so when I moved to San Francisco, I was really interested in providing care to these women whom society has often forgotten about. And so I actually sought out the medical director of the San Francisco jail and asked if I could do some work there. And that quickly led me not only to do clinical work, but also to conduct research because of what I was observing there as a caregiver.
How often were you there as a caregiver?
I was there once a week.
Mm-hmm. And what were you expecting to find in jail medicine, Carolyn, I wonder? And how did that match with what you did find?
Well, when I started, I had a lot of preconceived notions that perhaps many other people who don't know much about jail have. One, I didn't realize that there was a difference between jail and prison. So I learned a lot about how jail is integrated within the community in a lot of ways. Jail is under local jurisdiction, and many people only ever spend time in jail and never get sent to prison, which is where people go when they have been convicted of felonies and are serving larger sentences. So I think I was also expecting that everybody who worked inside a jail would be cruel or would be treating the people there with sort of degrading behavior and dehumanizing behavior. And while I certainly did observe some of that among both the guards and even at times among some of the medical staff, I also at the same time observed some staff who actually treated these women with a tremendous amount of compassion and that there was also a level of familiarity that many of the women had with the people who worked there. And that's because, getting back again to the jail issue, for a lot of people, they spend much of their lives, if they're trapped in the criminal justice system, cycling in and out of jail. So there is a level of familiarity that I was surprised. And then lastly, I was really surprised with the contradictions of the fact that here I was in a space of punishment, a jail, and yet I was tasked with providing medical care, which is a compassionate profession, and you know, our ultimate goal is to care for patients. And there were those contradictions that I felt between care and punishment in this same place, and also with the recognition that for some people, jail was the only place that they were able to access medical care.
And there's a woman you describe as Evelyn. I know you've had to change some names and identifying circumstances here, but she was pregnant and essentially volunteering. She turned herself in. Was that fairly typical, did you find?
I would say it's variable, but it was not uncommon. And for Evelyn, she did at one point in her pregnancy realize that she was just so down, so low, and had an inability to access prenatal care, and she knew that if she got into jail, she would get some prenatal care. And I would say, though, that I would qualify that, as she does with her quote, where she says, "I knew that even if it wasn't the best of medical care, I was going to get some type of care." And that's an important caveat when we think about this, what I learned in my research, that jail has become part of the safety net, especially for medical care, is that there is tremendous variability in the level and quality of medical services available. And where I worked at the San Francisco jail, services, at least according to what the women told me from being at other jails and also what I have observed nationally, that the services in the San Francisco jail were relatively better and more robust than at many jails across the country.
But this raises a question that is bound to make anybody either think deeply or feel uncomfortable or some combination thereof. I mean, as a society, do you think we've constructed a system in which a poor woman would think of going to jail as a safety net?
It is an extremely uncomfortable and unsettling conclusion that the research came to, absolutely. And I think that we should be uncomfortable with that, where we're at a point in our society where our safety net is in disarray, and at the same time, we've created the system of mass incarceration, which disproportionately houses people of color and poor people, and has created this situation for many people where the only place that they can access certain services is in jail. That is deeply problematic, and I think diagnoses a lot of the shortcomings of our society.
There is a lot to cover in the book. It's called Jail Care, Finding the Safety Net for Women Behind Bars. Carolyn Suffren is both MD and PhD, obstetrician, gynecologist, and anthropologist all in one. And so she spent some time at the San Francisco jail taking care of people and observing them as well. The results are all contained in the book. We'll come back and talk more about how jail functions as something of a safety net for pregnant women. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Carolyn Suffren and your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Carolyn Suffren, who is both an obstetrician gynecologist, therefore an MD, and a PhD in medical anthropology. She put the skills together in working at the San Francisco jail for women and put together a book called Jail Care, Finding the Safety Net for Women Behind Bars, with a primary focus on pregnant women who see jail as a safety net in some situations. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Lots to talk about with pregnant women in jail, but I want to focus on the babies for just a moment here, Carolyn. It's easy to forget about the baby. Who gets the newborn of a jailed woman?
Well, it depends. If we're talking about jail, which again, to remind listeners, jail is local county jails, and people are often there for short periods of time. But if it's in a county jail and a woman delivers a baby while she's in custody, then she is separated from the baby, and sometimes she'll be allowed to stay with the baby while she's in the hospital for her postpartum recovery, but otherwise the woman goes back to jail and the baby goes somewhere else. Where that somewhere else is depends on her circumstances. So if she's lucky to have support in her life, then a family member or other trusted person will be able to take care of the baby until she gets released from jail. But in many cases, that's not what happens. And I had several people in my study and who were also patients of mine who didn't have a trusted family member to take care of the baby. And what happened in those situations is the baby went into foster care. And once a baby goes into the state system, it is very hard for the woman to get visits with her baby and even to gain custody when she gets out of jail. Now, there are a few state prison systems across the country, and then one jail, Rikers Island Jail in New York City, where they have prison nursery programs, where they have special wings of the facility, where the mother and baby can stay together for varying periods of time. It might be a few weeks, or in one case, up to 18 months. And that allows the mother and the infant to have important bonding time, for the woman to develop certain parenting skills. It enables her to breastfeed if she wants. And so there are some potential benefits to these programs and to keeping moms and babies together, although it should also be recognized that it's still an incarcerated setting, and, you know, is that really the best place for a new baby and for a mother and infant to be, to be living and cultivating their family relationships?
But in fact, we were talking about the woman you describe in the book as Evelyn, clearly not her real name, but the pregnancy for which she turned herself into police so she could actually get some health care was her third, I understand. She already had two children she'd lost through the foster system?
Well, the first child, so both of those other children she gave birth to while she was in jail. The first one, yes, she lost to the system. In fact, that child was ultimately adopted and lives in another state on the other side of the country, and she has never seen him since the day he was born. The other child she gave birth to while in custody was eventually placed in the custody of a family member of Evelyn's. So she does have some connection to that that baby, but one of them she has never seen.
Wow. Well, let's talk about some of the reasons for jail existing as a safety net for women in these circumstances. The case Estelle versus Gamble, a court case, did what for health care behind bars?
So it's an incredible paradox, this case, Estelle versus Gamble. So this case made it to the Supreme Court in 1976, and it was based on a prisoner in a Texas prison system, Gamble. He was actually the defendant in this case. He alleged that he injured his back doing labor on the prison, and that his subsequent requests for medical care were inadequately addressed. And his case made it to the Supreme Court, and they determined that actually in his particular case he was adequately treated, but they used that as a platform to say, and here's a direct quote, "The deliberate indifference to the serious medical needs," end quote, "of prisoners is basically cruel and unusual punishment." And so from that moment on, from that case, prisons and jails and other institutions of incarceration are now constitutionally mandated to address prisoners' serious medical needs. And so there are a couple of caveats to that. One is there's no exact definition of what counts as a serious medical need, and that's why you get tremendous variability in terms of what medical services are provided to people. And then secondly, I think we all should pause to digest the fact that prisoners are the only people in our country with a constitutional right to health care. So when they're out in the free world, they do not have a right to health care, just like you and I do not have a constitutional right to health care. Then they become incarcerated and are stripped of most of their rights, but the one right they gain is a right to health care.
Well, I hadn't even thought of it in constitutional terms, but you're dead on. I mean, if it's considered cruel and unusual punishment, then the interpretation of the Constitution enforced now by the courts is that you have to have health care while you're in jail or prison.
That's right.
Wow. To say the care itself is that the care itself is contradictory because it's in a place designed to punish. So, and I wonder if that motivates the ways in which it is delivered or the ways in which it's budgeted or anything. I mean, what did you see in your experience where you worked and at any other jails you might have visited? I mean, is it sort of like a minimum thing, like we're just covering the bare minimum here in jail, or does it vary from jail to jail?
It completely varies from jail to jail, and there is no consistent way to even explain how much it varies. There are many jails across this country where they view the provision and the constitutional mandate exactly as you just said. There is a minimum we are required to provide, basically just keep them alive, and that's all we have to do. But then there are other jails where they view it more holistically, and they understand that jail is the people who are in jail are part of the larger community, and that there is a public health benefit and a benefit to the community to taking care of a more holistic sense of people's medical needs while they're in jail. And in addition, what people consider to count as a serious medical need varies. So, for instance, some people might not consider certain aspects of prenatal care or pregnancy care to be a serious medical need. And that ranges from everything to how prenatal care services are delivered, when it comes to accessing abortion services, when it comes to providing postpartum mental health care. It's just extremely variable what the facilities might deem to be a serious medical need.
You make a statement fairly early in the book that the health status of incarcerated persons is a case study in structural violence. It's a fairly strong term. What do you mean?
So structural violence is a term that we think about when we notice forms of violence that might not present in ways like actual physical violence, like a war or someone being being killed through through gun violence or other similar means that are sort of very visibly physical. Structural violence is a form of violence that manifests itself in unequal distribution of disease, of death, that tracks along differential social, racial, and political lines. And so, for instance, one example that is often given is thinking about the cholera epidemic in countries like Haiti, and that because of various social and structural factors, the rates of death and even the overall incidence of this in a country like Haiti are much higher than they are in a place that is that has better resources. That is an example of structural violence. Now, when I'm talking about it in terms of the health of incarcerated people, we know that people who are in our criminal justice system, when they enter prison or jail, they are much sicker than the general population of people in the community. And that's because so many of these people are poor, have had limited access to health care, limited access to quality nutrition, even employment and education. These things all manifest themselves in people being sicker. And that's not a direct consequence of physical violence, but of structural violence in the ways our society is organized to disproportionately impact poor health outcomes among poor people and also among people of color in our society.
Carolyn Suffren is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. A couple of skill sets she brought to her work at the San Francisco Women's Jail. She is an MD, an obstetrician and gynecologist, and a PhD as well, a medical anthropologist. She assembled a book about her years there and the other places she studied called Jail Care, Finding the Safety Net for Women Behind Bars, and this is primarily pregnant women. You can join our conversation on the Exchange. Questions and comments, welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Carol and I had heard the term school-to-prison pipeline. I had not heard that there's a sort of a women's parallel to that. What is that?
Many people are beginning to talk more openly and more vocally about the sexual abuse to prison pipeline, especially for women. And I saw this exemplified in so many of the women who were part of my research and my clinical care. And what this signifies is that so many women in our criminal justice system have suffered physical, sexual, or emotional trauma in their lives. And that often is deeply related to why they are in the criminal justice system in the first place, why some of them have committed crimes, most of which are largely nonviolent crimes. And so, for instance, the woman I call Evelyn, she was molested when she was a child, and this was deeply traumatic for her, as it is for all children. And she never got the mental health services that she needed. And so as she grew older, as she became a teenager and a young adult, she suffered from tremendous mental health difficulties, and this led her to self-medicate her pain with drugs, and then her struggles with addiction, which is a medical illness. Her struggles with addiction were not adequately addressed, and this soon led her to a life of being dependent on trading drugs and minor petty crimes associated with that, and that inevitably led her to get arrested and be in jail. And so much of the reasons that she ended up in jail so many times can be traced back to her initial experiences as a child that went unaddressed. And this was true for so many of the women, and in fact, national statistics estimate that nearly 90% of incarcerated women have suffered some form of abuse in their lives.
90%.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And how fast has the female prison population, I know we're talking about prison rather than jail here, but just incarcerated women, has increased by what percent?
So for the last several decades, women have been the fastest growing segment of the incarcerated population. We talk about mass incarceration and how we've seen exponential rises since the late 70s and the early 80s. And this is true for every demographic group, but it's more pronounced for women. And so between 1979 and 2008, 2009, there was an over 750% increase in the number of women behind bars. And the latest estimates from the Bureau of Justice Statistics estimate that on any given day, there are about 210,000 women behind bars. And that is a significant exponential rise compared to 40 years ago.
Wow, that's a huge increase, 750%. That is just amazing. You get also into the an area you call the policing of reproduction. And what do you mean by that? And how does that fall harder on poor people and women of color?
So in our society, we have taken a great interest in controlling the reproductive lives of women in general through laws, through access to health care, to the ways our lawmakers are getting into the very nitty-gritty ways that we as healthcare providers are supposed to provide reproductive health care, and that is everything from contraception access to prenatal and maternity care to abortion care. Our society in general has taken a great interest in controlling women's reproduction and access to reproduction through laws and other means. Now, what that means for, especially for poor women and for women of color, we have seen a number of examples in history in how people's reproduction is differentially controlled and valued based on their social status. And so as an example, when it comes to incarcerated women, they have very limited access to reproductive health care services, even as I argue in this book that for some women, jail is the only place where they get things like pregnancy care. But they have limited access to other reproductive health care services. And at the same time, you have examples in the state of California, and actually a story that just was reported within the last week, the example in Tennessee, where one county has incentivized women in jail to get sterilized or to get long-acting reversible contraceptive methods by saying, if you get one of these methods of birth control, we'll shorten your jail time. Now, when you think about the fact that women who are in custody in our country are disproportionately poor women and disproportionately women of color, that is a state-sponsored strategy to control their reproduction and limit their abilities to have pregnancies and have healthy pregnancies where they can safely and adequately parent their children without coercion.
Which we're talking to Carolyn Suffren about her book, Jail Care, Finding the Safety Net for Women Behind Bars, brings us back to the uneven distribution of race in jail. And we're talking about San Francisco here, though. It's the local jail in San Francisco, which is a very white city. What was the makeup of the women population there?
That's true. In San Francisco, the general population is approximately 6% African-American. And in the San Francisco jail, at least the latest statistics that I'm aware of, the population is more than 60% African-American, and you can see that just entering the jail. I saw that every day when I was conducting research and providing clinical care, that most of the women I interacted with were black women, and that is disproportionate to the general population. And that racial disproportionality is extremely prevalent, and it is a defining feature of our current system of incarceration.
You get probably some credit for being a doctor in face-to-face situations, but you're white and you're an anthropologist, too, and I wonder how that went over with some of the inmates.
Yeah, it's a tricky position to be in, and I was consistently aware of my own positioning as a privileged white woman and as a physician and as an anthropologist, and it's not something I think I ever fully resolved but embraced that trickiness. And I just, you know, I acknowledge to myself and to the women that that I'm in a different position than they are, and that I can never fully understand their experiences, but that I was committed to understanding it as best I could. And there certainly are some difficult things about being in that position and being in a relative position of power. And as an anthropologist, we think about this all the time. What is our legitimacy in representing the stories of other people? And I think that the best that we can do is to acknowledge and recognize the position that we're coming from and how that might influence our interpretation of things. And rather than sort of ignore that position and make it go away, just really confront that head on and be aware of the, with humility, of the limitations of what our subject position can tell us about what we're studying.
So be an honest reporter, but be aware of the limitations of your scope.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And being honest with the people that you're studying as well.
So on the days when you weren't there as a doctor, which you mentioned was one day a week, I don't know if it increased from that, but when you went back as an anthropologist, did you have the run of the place?
Well, I had an incredible amount of access because I had gained the trust of the people who worked there and gave me permission to do the research. And I wouldn't say I had the run of the place, but I would say that if I followed the rules and asked permission and called the right people at the right moments, that I was able to go into the housing units at most times of day or night, and also be in the clinical space and other spaces of the jail. So as long as I followed the rules, which I knew intimately from my time as a doctor there, I was given a tremendous amount of access.
Much more to talk about with Carolyn Suffren. Her book is Jail Care, Finding the Safety Net for Women Behind Bars. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Carolyn Suffren and you in a minute five. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are having a fascinating conversation with Carolyn Suffren, who is both an MD as an obstetrician and gynecologist and a PhD as an anthropologist, specifically a medical anthropologist. She studied women at a job that she did a couple days a week, actually one day a week, as a doctor at the San Francisco Jail for Women, and came out with a book called Jail Care, Finding the Safety Net for Women Behind Bars, and her focus was primarily on the women she dealt with, often pregnant women, in jail. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned as long as you followed the rules, you had access to pretty much all of this this jail that contained, and this is all the women in San Francisco in this one jail, right?
That's right. They're all housed in one location.
Mm-hmm. And so once the word got around about what you were doing, people fully understood what you were up to, did women begin to come to you and offer their stories?
They actually did. What I found was really incredible, although perhaps not surprising, was that people really wanted to tell their stories. They really wanted to be heard. And so I had women come to me and say, you know what, we would like journals so we can write our experiences down for you and you can use that information. I also had people, when they came to see me as their doctor, tell me some of their stories and say, I hope you can use this in my research. Now, I should just, as an aside, say that if they told me that in that context, I wouldn't use that information. I would go through the proper channels of research and obtaining consent and schedule a separate conversation with them at a later date. But it was just incredible. The women really wanted to share their stories. And I think that part of this comes from the fact that they feel really marginalized by society, that nobody thinks about them, or that if they do, they have stereotypical ideas about who they are. But they really wanted me and other people to know who they were, that these are women who have lives outside of jail. And that was, you know, one of the most rewarding things about doing this work, both as a physician and also as an anthropologist, was just hearing their stories and being able to share with everyone that these women are mothers, they're friends, they're aunts, they're people's daughters, and they have stories, they have senses of humor, they have skills, they are artists, they are cooks, they are people in our society, and it was really important to them that their stories get out there.
Somebody listening to them was probably a fairly rare thing.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, please?
Somebody actually listening to them was probably a pretty rare thing in their lives, I would think.
That's exactly right. And I noticed this sometimes in my role as a doctor. When I would start the clinical exam or the clinical visit, I would start by saying to the woman, "Hi, I'm Dr. Suffren. It's nice to meet you, Ms. Smith. How can I help you today?" And I would look at her in the eye and shake her hand. And I noticed so consistently that many of my patients were just taken aback by this greeting, by personalizing the greeting, by looking them in the eye and treating them with a basic level of respect and dignity. And that's what I do with all of my patients. That's how you treat people in this world. But so many of them had been used to being written off or disregarded in our society that this basic human decency of looking them in the eye and addressing them with respect was surprising to them.
Now, it has been, you did bring it up yourself in the book, and it needed to be mentioned. That, I mean, we are talking about San Francisco here, which is one of the more liberal cities in the country, if not the most liberal large city. What does that change, though, I mean, in its attitude towards safety nets and justice, about the way it treats women in its jail, and might that have given you a slightly skewed look at what jail care is like?
Well, it certainly gives a particular view, and I think it's critical to recognize the locality, that it is San Francisco, with a city with a generally robust commitment to helping its more underserved and vulnerable groups. And that's certainly manifested in some ways in the healthcare services that were available in the jail. And it was by no means perfect, but it was fairly comprehensive. And, you know, part of that is because it was a branch of the Department of Public Health, which in San Francisco, again, has a very progressive mission to providing comprehensive services. And so some people might say, oh, well, this is, you know, things are good there, and they are relatively better than not perfect. But what looking at a place where some of the basic things are in place tells us, you know, where women are not delivering babies in their jail cell while they're not categorically ignored. What you can learn, though, from that situation is that there are still a lot of problems. And if in a city like San Francisco, which invests a lot in its safety net, you still have this problem where some women feel that jail is the only place they can get medical care, that's problematic. If this is, you know, one of the better places, and this is what it teaches us about our safety net and mass incarceration in society, it's a lot worse, and it's deeply problematic throughout the country.
How much did you explore what the safety net was outside the jail, though? And I wonder what options might have existed for, and still do for that matter, for women in a situation like Evelyn's, where she's homeless, she's pregnant, and I think she might have still been doing drugs at the time. I mean, where could she have gone other than the jail, if any place?
So one of the places or categories of places that exist for pregnant women, especially those who struggle with addiction, there are residential drug treatment programs that are designed for mothers and babies, and there are several of them in San Francisco, but they're not enough. And Evelyn, I remember she said to me one time while she was in jail, she was reflecting on a prior time she was in jail this pregnancy when she... As soon as she got out of the jail, she went right back on the streets and started using. And she said to me, you know, it's not like I started using again because I wanted to. It was because I wanted to go to a program, but they kept telling me there were no beds, there were no beds, there were no beds. And that refrain, that I remember it from her saying, there were no beds, there were no beds. It speaks to the shortage of adequate services for these women. And, you know, I think investing in drug treatment and recognizing that addiction is a medical chronic disease, and that pregnant women have unique needs, I think that's a critical piece to this. It's not the only piece, and they're not the magic silver bullet answer, but having more drug treatment programs for women who are struggling addiction is something that could help many of these women who are instead being thrown in jail.
And what kind of drug treatment was available within the jail?
So there were some services that were available for pregnant women. If a woman was addicted to opioids, she was able to get methadone or buprenorphine, substitution therapy, and she was also able, in some cases, to be started within a treatment program that was in the jail. However, the continuity outside of jail was often not in place because there are, you know, a limited number of beds. But the San Francisco jail did provide some measure of drug treatment for women while they were pregnant women while they were in jail. But that is not universally the case across this country.
You do admit in jail care that your focus on women's reproduction narrows the field certainly a bit. I mean, and what sense did you get of the quality of jail care outside of what was provided to the women who were pregnant?
So, again, it's highly variable. At the San Francisco jail, it was fairly comprehensive, and I will be honest that some of that has to do with the fact that I was working there, and this was a special interest of mine, and so I helped to expand the services. They did have a basic amount of reproductive health care before I got there, provided by an excellent nurse practitioner. But the services that existed at the San Francisco jail for non-pregnant people included things like screening for cervical and breast cancer, screening for sexually transmitted diseases, treatment of abnormal periods, fibroids, women who were interested in contraception to prevent pregnancy when they got released from jail. These were just some of the reproductive health services that we were able to provide for women. There was also treatment for older women who were going through menopause. We were able to provide them with treatments for abnormal bleeding or hot flashes. So there was a fairly comprehensive program inside the jail for reproductive health services for women.
And you mentioned some knowledge of Rikers Island in New York, where the women get to be around their babies, and in some cases up to 18 months. How much sampling outside of San Francisco did you get on the level or offerings in healthcare at jails and other places in the country?
Well, for this particular book and the research I did for this book, I really focused on the San Francisco jail. But in other research that I've conducted and other research that exists, there have been surveys of reproductive health care services and pregnancy care services in jails across the country. And not surprisingly, those studies have shown a dearth of reproductive health care services, and that basically the minimum amount of care is provided. And by minimum amount, I mean a basic level of prenatal care, which sometimes is incredibly inadequate. But beyond that, no ability to continue a method of birth control they might have been on before incarceration, limited ability to screen for breast and cervical cancer, sort of thinking of this as a public health moment for preventative health care, and limited ability to screen and treat for sexually transmitted diseases because, again, as we talked about earlier in this conversation, some jails really view their role and the serious medical needs as just very basic and just keeping them alive without any sense of preventative health care services.
All right, so no particular maintenance or you know, well visits, but just taking care of the emergencies as they crop up.
That's right.
And I wonder, too, though, based on research that may not be included in this book, though, I mean, what the general attitude of inmates is and whether they think enough of the health care in lockups to seek it out or whether they will wait until parts are falling off before they'll go seek out health care.
That's an excellent question, and again, it is exceedingly variable, and not only based on the jail, but on the incarcerated person's experience. So people oftentimes have a lot of distrust of the healthcare system in jails and prisons, in part because of past experiences or what they observe, in part because sometimes they may be treated even by healthcare professionals with disregard or with a lack of full respect and dignity, and so they might distrust them, and so they may some people actually don't want full health care services from the jail that they're in. At other places, I've found in my other research and conversations with incarcerated women that they want more services, that they don't feel they're provided with enough, that they feel like when they bring their medical complaints to the attention of medical staff, they feel like they're dismissed. And so sometimes they want the health care, especially in other research I've done, especially when it comes to sexual and reproductive health care, some of them prefer to have it provided by an outside provider, meaning someone who's not employed by the jail health services or by the jail, because there are some issues with trust and fear in the people who work at the jail.
So did you have a chance, Carolyn, to keep track of some of the women who you mentioned here, Evelyn and Kima among them?
So that's a really good question, and I have been able to keep in touch with some of them. So there's one woman whom I talk about in the book, Alicia, who actually has never been back in jail after her pregnancy that she was in jail during. She is living independently in subsidized housing, and I would not say that just because she hasn't been back in jail, her life is a success. She still struggles with addiction. She still has challenges with the state in terms of her ability to see her child and develop relationships with them. The woman I call Evelyn, I had not been in touch with at all for 3 years. And then out of the blue, a few weeks ago, she actually contacted me And I was recently back in San Francisco and was able to see her in San Francisco. And she has not been back in jail for a year, but before that she had been back many other times. And she was finally at age 32, 33, she's about to turn, finally feeling like she was on a good track, and really proud of the fact that she was able to stay out of jail and get housing, and she's working on getting a job and other other things in her life together.
Individual stories aside, I mean, if people are to take jail care and make some recommendations and make some changes to the system, would those primarily be inside the jail or outside?
Well, I would say both. And I would first say what I would not want people to take away from this, which is I would not want anyone to take away from this that this is a good thing, that jail has become part of the safety net, because it is not. It is not appropriate that an institution of incarceration becomes part of our safety net. But I would hope that people would take away that we need to make investments in our community healthcare and other safety net services to support people, and so that they don't feel that jail is the place where they can get care. And then we also need to make improvements in the kind of care that is provided in jail, so that when people are in jail, they are getting quality, adequate health care.
Well, there's a whole lot to think about in here. Jail care, finding the safety net for women behind bars. Carolyn Suffren wrote it and joined us today in The Exchange. Carolyn, thank you so much.